I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And in this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be delving into the persona of one of the darkest, most troubled figures in American history, John Wilkes Booth. And I can't imagine any American alive today who wouldn't still know the name of John Wilkes Booth, even though he died, shot to death in 1865, not long after he had assassinated our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. We're going to be talking for the next few minutes about a new book called America's Original Sin, White Supremacy, John Wilkes Booth and the Lincoln Assassination, in which we see John Wilkes Booth's motive in the assassination tied to his growing fanaticism around what we think of as white supremacy. And it was certainly something that was playing out across the country in very dramatic fashion, particularly in the years of the Civil War and particularly after the Emancipation Proclamation. The author of this new book is John Roadhamel, who is former archivist of George Washington's Mount Vernon and previously the author of George Washington, The Wonder of the Age, The American Revolution, The Great Experiment, a number of other books, and now this, called again America's Original Sin. John Roadhamel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us what prompted you to want to examine John Wilkes Booth in such detail. Did anything in particular spark your interest?
Well, actually, I started on this quite a while ago. I've been working with John Wilkes Booth now longer than he was alive. He had a short life. He died at only 26. About 25 years ago, I published a collection of his surviving writings. And this he left behind several political testaments that make it very clear that white supremacy was one of the most important in the constellations of motives that led him to assassinate Lincoln. It's worth noting that at the time, there were hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of white men in the North as well as the South who thought that Lincoln deserved to die for betraying the white race. It's just John Wilkes Booth happened to be the only one who acted on that. But we think of Lincoln as a kind of revered martyr statesman. He's the principal secular saint in America's civic religion. But at the time, to the contrary, Lincoln in his own day was the most hated and the most controversial president in American history. And his most controversial and his most hated act was emancipation. The book, in a sense, is a dual biography of Booth and Lincoln. I start covering their lives in their childhoods, And you can see as their trajectories converge, as Lincoln moves toward emancipation, and at the very end of his life, as he proposes giving the vote to some black men, Booth becomes more and more angry until he reaches the point that he's willing to kill and does so. I think a lot of people, a sort of cliche understanding of this is that Booth was a drunken, crazy actor. And he was a drunk, but he wasn't mad in the sense of being psychotic. He was mad in the sense of being extremely angry.
Mm. I really appreciated how vividly you paint a picture of what unfolded in Richmond, Virginia, on the 4th of April, 1865. So this would be just days before the assassination takes place. And I think there's probably a fair number of Americans who might not have any awareness whatsoever of this dramatic scene. I knew of it, but I feel like I was there thanks to your vivid depiction of it. Explain what this scene is about that dominates chapter one of your book, and in particular, the scene of, as you call it, black joy paired with white despair that this moment represented.
The Civil War wasn't quite over. Lee wouldn't surrender for five more days, but Richmond fell to the Union on April 2nd and 3rd, 1865. And of course, Richmond had been the objective of 4 years of war. Ever since McClellan in 1862, the North had been trying to capture Richmond. When the city did fall, Lincoln, at General Grant's invitation, Lincoln was visiting the Army of the Potomac, and he said, I want to go to Richmond. I want to see it. And I have to say this was quite irresponsible on Lincoln's part because he was exposing himself to great danger in doing that. But he did walk the streets of Richmond that day, and he was greeted by the hosannas of newly freed slaves who regarded him as their savior. They said, "It's Master Lincoln. He's come to free us from bondage." And they were African Americans were swarming around him in the streets. He was on foot, without much of a bodyguard, and meanwhile, the white citizens of Richmond had shut themselves up in their houses, and they were essentially watching the end of their world through their windows. It was a definitive repudiation of white supremacy, because the first Union troops to enter the city had been regiments of the United States Colored Corps. They were black soldiers. And this was completely a Southern Armageddon. This was the end of the world to them. Lincoln took this risk because he was irresponsible about his safety, and that came out just a few days later. Of course, when he was assassinated at Ford's Theater, people told him not to go to the theater that night, but he went anyway and ended up getting a bullet in his brain.
Hmm. As for John Wilkes Booth, one of the things that is quite valuable about your book is that you describe the family that he was part of, a family of actors. I mean, they're almost like the Barrymores in a sense, and gifted actors, some of them very troubled and talented both. As for John Wilkes Booth, at what point in his life did his thinking begin to be, in a sense, infected by this notion of white supremacy? How early in his life do we begin to see indications of that?
I think as early as his childhood. He grew up in a slave state. He accepted slavery as a natural part of the world, as a proper thing. As an adult, he defended slavery, said it was best for the black race as well as the white race. So I think it went back to his earliest years, just as Lincoln's hatred of slavery went back to his earliest years. And in a sense, my book is a dual biography of Lincoln and Booth, and you can see their trajectories converging. as Lincoln moved toward emancipation, and at the end of his life, as he proposed giving the vote to some African-American men, Booth became more and more angry till he reached the point where he was willing to kill and had the opportunity to do so. But there were hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of other men in the United States, in the North as well as the South at that time, that believed Lincoln deserved to die. He was, we think of him as this wonderful, great president, but he was, at the time, he was controversial and hated by much of the population.
You remind us that for many white supremacists, their favorite way to refer to our 16th president was as King Abraham Africanus I. A friend to Africans in a way that they found utterly horrific and repulsive.
Absolutely. Booth thought the whole white supremacist edifice was being turned on his head. They always accused Lincoln of favoring blacks over whites. And, of course, they said he was willing to slaughter white men, meaning soldiers, to bring about the freedom of black slaves. Mm-hmm. They believed that the end of slavery would result in interracial marriage and therefore the what they called the pollution of the white race.
Mm-hmm. You remind us that white supremacists at certain turns would speak in more measured fashion about blacks. I mean, certainly never relinquishing the attitude that whites were superior to blacks, but sometimes those attitudes would be couched in what at a careless glance might seem like concern or compassion. That, in other words, it was for the best in terms of blacks. It was for their own good that they were, in a sense, living the lives that they were of enslavement, because whites mm-hmm. could take care of them and spare them from a life that would actually be far more terrible if they were left to their own sort of chaotic devices. I had not really read about that before. That's a fascinating thing to explore.
Well, you have to have some kind of rationalization for enslaving people, and that was one of them, that blacks were so feckless and irresponsible and improvident that if left to their own devices, they'd starve to death. They wouldn't support themselves. They also said that the 4 million enslaved black people in America were the happiest population on the face of the earth. They had nothing to worry about. They had no responsibility. They were cared for by their masters lovingly, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, that was not true at all. There wasn't a slave in America, I don't think, who didn't long to be free.
And you tell us, it's so interesting to think about something like the Emancipation Proclamation, how that would be viewed by a certain segment, particularly of the South. You tell us most white Southerners thought that emancipation was revolutionary, seeing in Lincoln's decree a dangerous appeal to violence that threatened to bring on cycles of horror and bloodshed in an apocalyptic race war. I mean, that really helps us understand at least part of what was driving the white supremacists in this era. It was not just their own racist attitudes, but also a terrible fear, of course, born of ignorance. And that's, of course, a very dangerous combination.
They believed that when two different races live together in a single nation, one has to dominate the other, or there will, or race war will break out. And they looked to the example of the French colony of Haiti, which it went through, in the 1790s, a genocidal, bloody, horrific race war where it really was black against white. They said without slavery to control the African Americans, there would be war between the two races, and the African Americans would lose the war and end up becoming extinct. So actually, to promote the survival of African Americans, they needed to remain enslaved. They had rationalized everything.
Fascinating. A last question. Your book essentially takes us, at some points, almost day by day through the life of John Wilkes Booth and that ultimate rendezvous with destiny where he assassinates the president at Ford's Theater, as we are all well aware. How is it that we can know so much about John Wilkes Booth, really throughout his life, but particularly those dramatic days leading up to the assassination? What were your most valuable sources for all of this information?
Well, in the National Archives, there's a file, all the evidence that was accumulated by the trial of Booth's co-conspirators. So there are a lot of sworn affidavits of people describing this. We also have a memoir that Booth's sister Asia wrote, Asia Booth Clark, that's very valuable. It wasn't published until 1938, 50 years after her death, but she describes a lot of Booth's letters, a lot of Booth's beliefs. And we also have his own writings where he's communicating with other members of the conspiracy. The assassination obviously has been intensely studied by generations of scholars. And except for interpretation, I don't think there's anything new in my book. It's the sort of detective story, the events leading up to the assassination, is well known and is very extensively documented.
It's a marvelously crafted book, again titled America's Original Sin, White Supremacy, John Wilkes Booth and the Lincoln Assassination, published by Johns Hopkins University Press, the author, John Rodhamel. John Rodhamel, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're turning to the Morning Show archives and returning to the theme of 9/11, 20 years after the events of that terrible day. And we'll hear from the author of one of the most definitive books about that important event in our recent history. Those of us of a certain age, we'll never forget the events of September 11th, 2001. But as my morning show guest Mitch Zukov points out in his remarkable book, Fall and Rise, The Story of 9/11, there is already an entire generation that has no direct memory of 9/11. It is for them, and not only for them, that this really important book has been constructive. It's a massive book and a meticulously researched book that seeks to tell the story of 9/11. It's 8:29. This is actually an incorrect file that is intended to be broadcast another day. This is actually part two of today's program. My apologies. And in part two of today's morning show, we're going to be talking about a very intriguing play that is opening tonight at the 6th Street Theater in downtown Racine, a production by the Over Our Head Players of a play called Nixon's Nixon, which presents what perhaps unfolded in some respect on one of the most dramatic nights in the life of Richard Nixon, the night before he announced to the public his resignation. And in this play, we will be seeing on stage Rich Smith, who was also the director of this production, and he is managing artistic director of the Over Our Head Players. And this is actually their second play of this new season. And we'll be talking about how this play is constructed and talking about various aspects that make it so compelling. Rich Smith, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for having me. Good to talk with you
again. I'm glad we can have this conversation. Ahead of us talking about the play that opens tonight and runs for a total of 3 weekends, I want to talk first about what life has been like for the Over Our Head Players during this unhappy period of the COVID-19 pandemic, which, of course, by no means is over. But at the height of the pandemic, of course, performing arts pretty much ground to a halt, including live theater in front of in-person audiences. I assume the Over Our Head Players had to go on an extended hiatus. I wonder if you can just describe what that period was like and how the company carried on during that time.
Oh, of course. I mean, everyone has, you know, it's affected everyone, obviously. But you're right, Greg. You know, live theater is right in the middle of the bullseye of everything that could not be done when this all started. So, you know, the Over Our Head Players were real proud of the fact that when this all started to come to light back in March of 2020, you know, we were among the first, if not the first, theater in Milwaukee, Chicago, and our area to completely halt, cancel a production. We did that in early March of 2020 out of a preponderance of caution and uncertainty, and we wanted to do the right thing, and we went 540 days without a live audience, and that's really hard to do. It's hard to do for any theater, but, you know, a community theater, and I know you're familiar with that, and a small one on top of it presented a lot of challenges. You know, we're not filmmakers. We're live theater people, but we became filmmakers, and we did some online things to stay alive, and great support from our subscribers, which have been growing over our 30 years of existence, helped keep us afloat, and we're just ready to get back in the game now. We think we can do it safely. We've learned an awful lot about this awful thing we dealt with for the last year and a half, and we're ready to take some steps back into living life again.
Very good. Before talking about some of the protocols that will be in place to try to keep performers and audience members alike safe during these performances, I wonder if you could kind of sketch for us your understanding of the history of the Over Our Head Players and the place that you think it has in kind of the cultural landscape of the city of Kenosha and of the city of Racine and Southeast Wisconsin in general.
Yeah, thanks for asking that, Greg. We appreciate that. And we do think we're part of Kenosha. We've got a lot of Kenosha talent that performs with us and a lot of Kenosha audience members as well. We began, this is our 30th season of live theater in downtown Racine. We began 30 years ago doing productions in a bar, in George's Bar on Main Street in Racine. And we were a group of people that just wanted to take some chances, do some theater that was out of the box, something a little different, challenge our audiences a little bit. And we knew Racine had just a fantastic theater community. You know, a lot of us are also affiliated with the Racine Theater Guild on the other side of town and respect that and totally know Racine's intelligent, savvy theater community, and we knew that there was a way we could complement it, certainly not compete with it, but complement the theater offerings that are given in our community. And so we took some chances, and a few years after that, we got our own space here at 318 6th Street in beautiful downtown Racine. So we're operating out of our own storefront theater now for our 23rd, 24th season, 30 seasons altogether, and still going strong.
Very good. At what point did you become managing artistic director, and what kind of responsibilities do you shoulder in that position?
Well, I think it happened on the first day when we were sitting on a bar stool and someone had to direct this first play that we did. But I was a theater student at the time at Parkside. I finished my theater degree at Carthage. Just over the years, the group just sort of evolved that way. When we got a board of directors They voted me in and asked me to take on the position of managing artistic director, and I've been fortunate enough to serve in that capacity ever since.
The last time that I saw you on stage, I'm pretty sure the last time I saw you on stage, at least one of the last times I saw you on stage, was on the stage of the Racine Theater Guild, portraying former Green Bay Packers coach, the legendary Vince Lombardi. And I've seen you, of course, in other roles. I can think of a couple of others in which you have, in a sense, been, I don't know if this is a demeaning term or not, but impersonating an actual historic figure. I mean, and doing a remarkable job of it. I mean, in terms of evoking their persona, their voice, their cadence. It's a special gift that not all that many people have. I wonder how long you have had this ability, and can you point to any particular facet of your own talent and personality that gives you the ability to do this so exceptionally well?
Well, thanks, Greg. That's really high praise. I really appreciate that. That's fantastic. You know, the only reason I did a great job in Vince Lombardi as Vince Lombardi was because your wife was in the booth making me look really good every night. You know that. But thank you. I don't like talking about myself too much that way, but I started acting at a young age. And I knew I loved it. And after a while, you find out what you're good at. You know, someone blessed me with a nice rubbery face, so I can do things I want to do, and a lot of work on vocal variation. Really fortunate to play these two great men in particular. I mean, Vince Lombardi, wow, what a challenge there. But now Richard Nixon. A lot of studying, a lot of film study has to go into it. For Nixon's Nixon, we're working with a friend of ours who is a professional impressionist who has also given us some tips in that area. So it doesn't come as easy as it looks, but I guess that's the idea of acting. So, but thank you for asking the question. Yeah, nice challenge and very fortunate.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Rich Smith, who is Managing Artistic Director of the Over Our Head Players in downtown Racine. And he is also directing and starring in their next production, which opens tonight. It's a play by Russell Lees called Nixon's Nixon. First of all, Rich Smith, when did you first become acquainted with this play? When and how?
The play gained popularity back in the late 90s. Russell Lees put it out there, and that's when I first read it. You know, we thought about doing it at one time. We weren't at George's Bar anymore. It was in our early days here, and oddly enough, the Milwaukee Rep beat us to it, and we didn't get the rights, and so we sat on it for a while, and it's kind of been in the back of our minds as something that we've wanted to do. And it's still so relevant. I mean, the play was written in the late 90s. It's a dark comedy about, you know, obviously a very crucial historical evening in American history. And so it's still very relevant. It still serves a purpose of good, interesting theater, give people something to talk about after and laugh at during. And we've wanted to do it for a while. And, you know, with some of the COVID things that have come out, we really focused, especially early this season, on plays that only had one or two actors. And that's why this one sort of rose to the top of our consideration again. And we were lucky enough to get the rights this time.
So explain to our listeners kind of the overall shape of this play, and a little more about its specific setting. I know it's a relatively brief play with no intermission, so that sounds an awful lot like my own personal favorite play, Doubt, by John Patrick Shanley. So it sounds like this may be a similar sort of experience, and for those of us who prefer our plays to be short and with a lot of impact, this might really fill the bill. Tell us more about this, how this play is shaped.
Exactly. That's a great way to describe it. It is It's short. It runs about 75 minutes. There is no intermission. We will still be serving concessions, and at our theater, you can bring them. You can bring them in with you if you like. So that's happening. But very, very powerful 75 minutes. You know, it is an actual event. You know, the evening before Richard Nixon decided to resign and rode up, it's a fact that he and Henry Kissinger met in the Lincoln sitting room at about 10 p.m. for more than a few hours, and nobody really knows what they talked about. Kissinger's hinted at it from time to time in different interviews and books, but a lot of it's very, very private. And Russell Lee's kind of takes a very dark, comical spin on maybe some of the things they discussed that night, and just how out of control to some extent that Nixon was. He was drunk when Kennedy got there. He'd been drinking, and he was depressed, and such an interesting man that the time they spent together in this meeting could have covered anything. And that's kind of where this play goes. It just bounces you all over. And that 75 minutes, you hopefully you're going to laugh. I hope we'll make you cry, but we'll try to, maybe for the right reasons, I hope. But it will certainly make you think, and will certainly give you something to talk about on your drive home.
Right. So would you say that the playwright is trying to imagine what actually transpired? I mean, there's no way for anybody except Mr. Nixon and Mr. Kissinger themselves to tell us exactly what shape that conversation took. But, I mean, is he trying to imagine a very plausible possibility, or is he thinking, in a sense, more fancifully and creatively than that?
Exactly. You know, I think it's the latter. I think it's sort of an out of the box, you know, fancifully, as you put it, look at what might have happened. You know, the things we know about Nixon, he didn't like people. And he was a brilliant politician. You know, people look back at history and think, well, he was bad. No, he was a brilliant politician. He had tremendous success from early age on, and won 72 in a landslide. He had everything going for him. He just was so insecure and so paranoid to some extent. And he distrusted, and he really did not like people. And that was his greatest downfall, because a lot of the things that happened to him, of course, Watergate, he didn't need it. He didn't need to spy on the Democrats. He won by a landslide, but his faults are what really brought him down. And I think Russell Lee's looks at this play in sort of it's not even about politics. It's just about a very interesting human being who is put in a very difficult position and forced to make a very difficult decision, and how he gives up this power, and the interesting character of Henry Kissinger in the room with him trying to help him, who may have his own motives.
How much does the play spell things out in terms of context versus how much context does the playgoer need to have before they walk into the theater and settle into their seat? I'm not sure that's a terribly clear question, but I mean, and of course, certain people of a certain age are already going to know very much about Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger and the circumstances under which this conversation takes place. But for someone, for instance, much younger or born under a rock or whatever, who really don't know about this moment in history, does the play make that clear, or is it important for them to have some understanding of that before the play even begins?
That's one of the brilliant things about this script, Greg, is I don't think you need to come in here even knowing who Richard Nixon was. I really think you can enjoy this play and take it in as a man of power who's in an awful position. And sure, there are very relevant and different facts that are brought up, but the story itself isn't driven by a lot of that at all. It's more about this conversation and what happens. But we're also aware that, you know, hey, hopefully our audience is not all of the age to remember this. We try to reach out to younger people, and so we're staging it in kind of a unique way. We've got video screens that are part of the set behind the actors. So throughout the performance, certain images will come up, maybe of famous people that they're talking about, or the Vietnam War, or Watergate, or whatever. That'll kind of help the audience sort of go back to that time and help appreciate more what they're talking about. So in some regards, it's a bit of an educational experience as well as a fun and enjoyable, powerful play. But I don't think you need to be familiar with this stuff to get it and enjoy it. And I think that's the brilliancy of the writing.
Hmm. What kind of a set do you have for this production? Is it fairly realistic, or is it a more sort of suggestive setting?
Yeah, people have been to the Sixth Street Theater know that, you know, we're very intimate theater. We seat about 90 people. We're only seating at half capacity now for COVID. We're spacing people out, so there'll be a little more elbow room. But our stage is a small one. We do a lot on it, though, and we can create a lot of unique areas and spaces and places. For this play, we have to recreate the Lincoln sitting room, which is a room in the White House. And so we contemplated how we would do that. Are we going to put up the real walls and try to match the wallpaper and the images and the pictures? And then we thought, well, let's do this with the video images, and let's just make sort of a black box studio-style setting with red curtains around us and a couple of American flags and, of course, a big console stereo system that Nixon loved to listen to his classical music on. And then we'll let the images on the screen sort of help the play move along. So the furniture pieces are real, the costumes are real, the actors are real, the set pieces are real, but the walls around them are up for the imagination of the audience. And that's one of the things I love about black box theater, studio theater. So we're kind of melting a traditional proscenium experience into something like that with this setting.
We're speaking with Rich Smith about the Over Our Head Players production of Russell Lee's play, Nixon's Nixon, which opens tonight at the Sixth Street Theater in downtown Racine. Rich Smith, explain to our listeners a bit about the relationship historically between Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger. Exactly what we know about both their professional and personal relationships, because I think that helps us really understand the significance of this moment in their respective lives.
Yeah, they needed each other, you know, and you know, Henry Kissinger, you know, Nixon basically gave him his first real, you know, public servant job and a huge title because he was such a brilliant man and incredibly knowledgeable about history and world affairs. And Kissinger, you know, became this rock star. He was respected in every circle, both sides of the aisle, and, you know, got most of the accolades for getting out of the Vietnam War. You know, that was Nixon's campaign promise, and Henry kind of took the Peace Prize and all of the raves for that. There were some bad too. Now you talk about, you know, Cambodia and some other quote unquote tricky business that Kissinger was involved in. But the two men didn't necessarily like each other, but they knew that they needed each other. You know, Henry Kissinger knew Nixon was not a people person. He thought he was a little caustic. He thought he was often mean and short. And Nixon was, on the other side, quite jealous of the popularity and respect that Kissinger had. It's sort of what Nixon always wanted. And I think he just sometimes tried too hard to get that. He was so paranoid and in his shell, he couldn't have what Kissinger had. And there was a bit of a jealousy there. And certainly some of that, you know, comes out in the play. But two very interesting men. And Kissinger, you know, went on to serve for Ford, and is in the history books as, despite some downfalls, a very respected world leader.
So tell us about the task of portraying Richard Nixon, someone who, of course, has been fodder for all kinds of impressionists and comedians and dramatic actors for that moment. I mean, and someone with a very distinctive voice and very distinctive style of speaking. Tell us a little bit about how you have approached the challenge of bringing our, I think, 37th president, if I remember correctly, to life.
Correct.
On the stage.
Yeah, another good one. So yeah, it's not done alone. You know, I mentioned that I'm on there as the director of this production, but I'm working with a couple of assistant directors and some other eyes. I've kind of landed into this duplicate role, you know, because of COVID and trying to keep a lean staff. So my focus has been on the acting portion, probably more so than the directing portion, although my name is there. Such a recognizable person. You can't overlook anything. There's the vocal timbre that you're going to have to try to find. And he had the way that he kind of spoke from the back of his mouth and of course his hand gestures and his slouched shoulders and the arm behind the back. Those are all sort of the easy things and the meter of his speech. Lots of video study, lots of film study. I tried to not watch other actors impersonate him, but I did a little bit of that. And the playwright comes out and says at the very top of the play in his notes to the director that you don't have to. You can just read these as two human beings. You don't have to try to imitate these actors, and the play will work. And I've read reviews of this play where they've done just that, where they didn't even make an attempt. And still got great reviews. I think it loses a little bit of entertainment value if you do that. And so we chose to sort of approach it from the other side and try to impersonate these men. Of course, I don't look a whole lot like Richard Nixon. And the actor Michael Retzlaff, who's fantastic, who's playing Henry Kissinger, really looks nothing like Henry Kissinger. But we know that if we can pull off the mannerisms as actors and the vocal meter and the timbre and the personality will come out. We think that makes it a lot more entertaining, and that's the choices that we've made.
What has it been like for you to serve as director and be one of the two actors in this particular production? I mean, you've just already kind of explained why that choice was made, and it makes a great deal of sense, but that doesn't mean that it isn't tricky or challenging to be, in a sense, wearing both of those hats simultaneously in this production.
Yeah, over the years, I've found myself there a few times, usually with a 10-minute comedy, you know, in Snow Dance. Those are easy. a 75-minute piece like this is a huge challenge, and it comes with a lot of help. We have a fantastic stage manager, Melissa Zian, who has a fantastic eye for what's going on stage and totally understands our vision and where we are as actors, and she's been an enormous help. Ron Schultz is serving as our assistant director, and he's been an enormous help. The stress of worrying about all the other things that a director has to worry about on the production, you know, from the set to the lighting to the way the play moves and the style and the vibe that you want to present for your audience, all that stuff, it kind of comes easy for me if I'm this in love and this engrossed in the production, which I think every actor has to become. You know, that stuff comes easy, but the actual directing comes with a lot of help on a piece like this, for sure.
As I said earlier in the interview, my own personal favorite play is Doubt, which is probably about this long, I'm guessing, and done without intermission. And I just really appreciate a play that sort of moves along like this and, in a sense, leaves the audience wanting more. I wonder what it feels like for you as an actor to be on the stage in a play like this that is relatively compact in its length and also delivered without any kind of intermission. And if that feels different and if it makes things easier or harder for you and your castmate.
I think it makes it a little easier. You know, the 75 minutes that we're out there just flies by. It gets a little warm for us. We're both big guys who sweat. So there's that going on. It is certainly different. And I'm all for quick theater. I'm the same way as you, Greg. This is one of the reasons I love the Snowdance 10-minute comedy festival. I like just nice little bursts of entertainment, and there it goes, you know. But intermissions serve a great purpose for theaters, give the audience a break, sell some concessions. There's a little financial end of it there. But attacking this play with all the energy that it has and the roller coaster of emotions and all thrown out there in that 75-minute stretch is definitely, it's a workout. Every production, every performance for Michael and I is a workout. By the time it's over, we're not only physically exhausted, but a little emotionally and mentally as well. Mm-hmm. But it flies by. When you're an actor out there in something like this, all of a sudden it's over and you go, wow, that was 75 minutes? How'd that happen?
Explain what protocols are in place, what have been in place through the course of your rehearsal period, for that matter, but most importantly, in terms of the performances themselves, in terms of keeping members of the audience safe.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. So we did open a play in August called The Lady with All the Answers that was about Ann Landers. It was sort of by design that we sort of entered back into live theater by staying in the 1970s. We wanted to get out of the 2020s as quickly as possible and give our audience something to look back at and enjoy rather than deal with anything too contemporary. But when the Ann Landers play opened in August, we were actually in a better place as far as COVID restrictions and different things. And so we've had to turn things up a little bit and set some standards. We're trying to stay in step with what other like businesses are doing, but we're also trying to stay realistic and respect everyone's experience. So our performers are all vaccinated. That's a must for the rest of our season. If you're performing on stage, you'll have to be vaccinated with the overhead players. Audience is going to have to adhere to the city's mandates. Right now, the city of Racine says you have to have a mask on when you're in a public building unless you're actively eating or drinking. And so we're holding ourselves to that. We're not checking for vaccination cards at the door. You know, there are, you know, theaters in New York and some other larger venues that are doing that. We don't want to get into that debate. We certainly don't want to ask our volunteer ushers to be in that position. And so we're asking that everyone's an adult. They'll come in and they'll behave the way the city wants them to behave, and so will we as an organization. As performers, we can be on stage without masks, and so we'll be doing that. We're seating at half capacity in our theater, which helps. We've got some air exchangers and air handlers that'll be running through the performance that we don't usually do to keep the air moving. We have a disinfectant fogger that we purchased that we disinfect the entire room with before every production. So we're doing that. Of course, there's the typical, everybody's gotten used to the plastic sneeze shields, right? Those are up in the lobby, of course. Touch-free credit cards. Our ushers have all been trained on how to sort of space people out in the lobby so things don't get too crowded and sort of exit in a responsible fashion so no one's walking over each other. So those are the types of steps that we've taken. They're not unlike what other theaters very nearby are also going to be doing, and I think audiences are going to be adjusting and getting used to it. And we hope when people are ready to come back for live theater, we hope they do. I hope it's tomorrow night. I hope it's tonight.
Rich Smith is the managing artistic director of the Over Our Head Players. Nixon's Nixon opens tonight. It runs for 3 weekends. The website address for the Over Our Head Players is overourheadplayers.org, and their phone number is 260.